Welcome, everybody. This week is a very, very auspicious week. The Parsha is Tetzaveh. It is also the week, the Shabbos before Purim. So we also read from the section which recounts the war against Amalek and the commandment to always remember what Amalek did. Zachor, remember, and this Shabbos is nicknamed Shabbos Zachor, the Shabbos of Remember. We are already getting into the mood of Purim, which occurs Monday night and Tuesday. So there's really a lot in the air at this time. I will caution you that what we are going to speak about today is quite heavy. We're really going to use the Parsha as a springboard to discuss our real theme of this class, which is the Mesilas Yesharim, the Path of the Just, a sefer of Jewish ethics that we have been following for over a year now, and this year doing it even more earnestly, following along a ladder of ethical virtues which a person acquires step by step. It is basically this book, written by Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lusato in the 1700s, outlines a Jew's climb up the spiritual ladder. It is not something that you learn in Hebrew school, and it is something which we will be fortunate to study at all during our lifetime and hopefully make some progress. But it really is the mature side of Judaism, of understanding of the Torah, and the ideas that we discuss in this class. I'm just saying this for the benefit of those who are new. And the good news is that there are a lot of people who keep coming back, so that's heartwarming. But what we have to say today particularly is something which is not for the faint of heart. Spiritually. Okay, so please, if you buckle, put your seatbelts on, I think we will be able to walk together and discover, I'm not talking about Kabbalah or anything, but I am talking about some challenging ideas, spiritual concepts, which are very seminal. To tie into the Parsha, because this is a Parsha class after all, in this Parsha, we are instructed, Moshe is instructed, to relay to the Jewish people the second phase of the construction of the Mishkan, of the Tabernacle, and that is particularly the clothing, the vestments, which should be fashioned to garb the priest. Famous at the beginning is the 8 vestments that the high priest wears. And what I'd like to quote just now is chapter 28, verse 2. You shall make vestments of sanctity for Aaron your brother, for glory and splendor. And I would really like to spend the entire class speaking about the word glory, or in Hebrew, kavod. Because I saw something this week as I was studying from the Mesilas Yesharim, which really made me kind of tremble, figuratively speaking. And I would like to share that with you and to discuss it. I also feel, and I say we're going to speak only about Kavod, I also feel that the lesson from today is directly related to and impacted by the essence of the story of the Megillah of Purim. And I'll explain how that ties in, God willing. What I read today, this week, and I got to do a brief recap of where we're holding in this book. We are... I mentioned different virtues. We are on the virtue of Nikius, cleanliness. This is already the second time we've extended. We were supposed to spend 40 days successively on a virtue. We have extended Nikius for another 40 days. So we are on the second time around for cleanliness, and it is day number 27 out of 80. No, 67 out of 80 that we have been focusing on this virtue. In brief, if I could read to you a summary of a definition of cleanliness. So far in this book, we have learned of vigilance, tzihirus, or watchfulness. It is a skill whereby a person develops the ability to think before he acts. That is much easier said than done, because we have a motor inside of us which propels us to act first, think later. But Zahira says, no, you can learn how to think first and then act, and don't do things unless you have decided that this is what you ought to be doing. That is the virtue of Zahira's of watchfulness. After watchfulness comes the virtue of Zrizus, alacrity. Others translated as diligence, and that is a trait to be able to get oneself to do that which one knows he should do. And that is easier said than done, because we are also programmed, just as we have this motor that propels us to do things without thinking, we also have another program that says, don't do things. Just sit. It's called lethargy or laziness, and another corollary to that is fear. Don't do things because you're afraid. I'm uncomfortable with it. It's unknown. I'm not used to it. I can't really bring myself to do it. So the second virtue, diligence, is the skill of learning how to overcome that lethargy and how to overcome that fear. Which leads us to the third virtue, which we are currently analyzing, and that is cleanliness. Another translation, which I've never seen or shared with you, I just learned about it this week, is wholeness. Wholeness. What does wholeness mean, or what is nikius? Wholeness means the person is completely devoid of bad traits and sins, even those that individuals tend to rationalize away. When we acquire wholeness, we are not swayed by physical desires. We learn to withdraw away from every sin, even those that are minor. The difference between watchfulness, which was our first trait, and wholeness, is that watchfulness means to be watchful with our deeds and not to transgress in obvious ways. Wholeness means to keep our hearts from being pulled in subtle ways by natural lust and rationalization. So nikius, the trait of nikius, of cleanliness or wholeness, is taking vigilance, watchfulness, to another level. Now, Rabbi Luzzatto writes the longest chapter on various details of wholeness, of nikius. First, he goes through a lot of the well-known transgressions, and he says these are the not-so-well-known aspects of these well-known transgressions, and teaches us how to look at it with a fine-tooth comb. Then he does the same thing with what we call the midos, the character traits, and he says there are some very prominent character traits that people possess, and if you really wish to clean oneself of them, you have to look at it with a fine-tooth comb. And the one that I want to focus on today is chemdas hakavod, the desire for honor or glory. And I'm going to read it to you, and you'll see why I trembled. First of all, before describing the desire for kavod, for honor, he says that is really a sister trait, and that is the desire for money. He says that people primarily desire two things, money and honor. And what he says is, and let me ask you this question, which of the two do you think is a stronger force? The desire for money or the desire for honor?
Money. Honor.
That's what you want, the money.
Money.
Money. Let's go around the room. Ms. Redick?
Money.
She's eating lettuce.
Honor. Steve?
Which is the biggest desire?
Which is a stronger desire? Money or honor?
I guess money.
Money. Herb?
Well, with money I can buy, can afford honor. Money.
Money?
Honor.
You said honor. We got two honors so far.
Money in these days.
Money these days.
Honor.
Honor.
It should be honor, but money is what most people...
Okay.
Money.
Money.
Honor.
Honor.
Money.
Honor.
All right. All right.
There was a song in Mamma Mia, I think.
Isn't there a song in Mamma Mia that calls money?
Okay, this is what Rabbi Luzzatto writes.
What page, please?
Page 87. The desire for honor. Worse than this, that is, worse than the desire for money, is the desire for honor. Mm. A person would be able to overcome his desire for money and other enjoyments were it not for the pressure exerted upon him by the desire for honor. You see, I think everyone's right. Because the reason why people want money is because money means honor. He says that people would be able to overcome their desire for money and other enjoyments were it not for the pressure exerted upon him by the desire for honor. For he cannot endure seeing himself inferior to his peers. That's the key. The key is, a person cannot endure seeing himself inferior to his peers. Over this matter, many have faltered and perished. Many have faltered and perished. Who are these people? Who are these many? Are we talking about, you know, people on the street? Are we talking about Hollywood? We're talking about giants of Tanakh. We're talking about kings, sages, righteous people. Yeravam ben Nevat, the first king of the split kingdom.
What's the name?
Yeravam.
Jeroboam.
Jeroboam. They made a song for him. Jeroboam. Jerabim. He was barred from the world to come only because of his desire for honor. This is what the sages of blessed memory said. You know, he was starting this new kingdom, and he was starting, it was in the north, so it wasn't, Jerusalem was not in his jurisdiction. And he did not want the people to go to Jerusalem because that was the competition. So he said, you don't have to go to the temple anymore. We bring our sacrifices in our own places. And he erected even false altars, which is a tremendous transgression. So at one point, the sages revealed to us, I don't think this is in the Tanakh, but the sages revealed that Holy One, blessed be He, grabbed Yeravam by his garment and said to him, repent, and I, and you, and Ben Yishai, who's Ben Yishai? King David. David Ben Yishai. We'll walk in Gan Eden, just the three of us. Can you imagine being invited to sit in God's skybox at the game? Is that what it's called? Yeravam said to him, ah, great, who will be in the lead? The Eternal said, Ben Yishai will be in the lead. Yeravam said, well, if that's the case, I'm not interested. He gave up the world to come, sitting in the box seat with God, because he would be number two to to King David. What caused Korach to perish? And along with him, his whole entourage of 250 great wise men, tzaddikim. It was only the desire for honor, as Moshe called him on it and said, "And you desire to have priesthood as well?" The spies not wanting to go into the land of Israel. This is based on the interpretation of the Zohar. The Zohar says this is not the common explanation, but the Zohar says that what brought about their evil report about the land was their fear that their honor might be diminished upon entering Eretz Yisrael, because others might replace them as Israel's Nisim, leaders of the tribes.
Why did they think that? I mean, why would...
Because it was going to be a whole new restructuring of the tribes. And now, there are other explanations. This is not the popular one that's taught. There are other explanations, too. But this is the Zohar. What prompted Shaul's effort to waylay David? Shaul spent much, much of his life trying to pursue and kill David. So we would say, well, he thought that David was a usurper of the kingship, etc. Rabbi Lutzata says it right out. He was because of honor. He heard women celebrating David's victories. They had a little song that said, Shaul smote thousands and David tens of thousands. And Shaul looked askance at David from that day onward. And on and on. In summation, the desire for honor is what grips a person's heart more than all the worldly wants and desires. If not for this, a person would be content. Okay, now listen to this. What would a person look like if he did not have this desire for honor? A person would be content to eat whatever is at hand, to wear whatever would cover his nakedness, to dwell in a house that would protect him from the elements. Making a living would be an easy matter. A person would not need to exert himself at all in order to prosper. Wow. No financial worries. However, this is why I was trembling. Because he cannot endure seeing himself humiliated and lowered before his peers, he enters this fray with no end in sight to all his labor. With this in mind, our rabbis of blessed memory have said, Pirkei Avos, Ethics of the Fathers, no Kabbalistic sources here. 421, envy, lust, and the pursuit of honor remove man from the world.
You know, it's interesting. Everywhere I see that is 421, but when I look for it, it's only 428.
There's different divisions mm-hmm. Of the Mishnah there. In conclusion, I note that the desire for honor is one of the greatest obstacles that faces man. And he cannot be a faithful servant to his master as long as he worries about his own honor. For inevitably, such a person would end up diminishing the honor of heaven for the sake of his own foolishness. Okay, we'll come back. Yes.
Someone may not want to have a demeaning occupation because it doesn't fulfill his skills, and his ability is far greater than his.
Did you read my notes? When I read this, and I think other people, they squirm in their seat and they say, is this suggesting, and he quoted some other things, some very, very, explicit statements. Flay a carcass in a marketplace, and do not say, I am an important person, I am a Kohen. Another statement, Talmud, one should always take on work that is unfamiliar to him instead of being dependent on the help of others. Now, people hear this and they squirm in their seats and they say, "You mean the Torah is saying I should be a busboy? I should be a gravedigger? I should be a butcher and slaying meat? Is that what the Torah expects of us?" That just totally rubs me the wrong way. That's what I would react as after reading this. And if I could just say this, what he's talking about is that some people, because they don't want to subject themselves to anything less than the best, what they do is they may become dependent on charity. And what Rabbi Luzzatto, I think, is saying is, listen, guys, it could very well be that God, who is the provider, who knows everybody's capabilities, would be happy to provide you with an occupation that does take into account your abilities and a certain degree of honor. But because that's not good enough, therefore, realize the foolishness of your actions, man. You are doing something which is much more debased than even that job that you didn't want to have. It's trying to illustrate to us how fickle man is, how foolish man is. The sages are not saying you should be a grave digger. What the sages are saying is that the kinds of things that people resort to because they're not given that highest position is worse than even a grave digger. You would have been better off digging graves than acting the way that you're acting. That's what I think they're saying. If a person would rather say, you know, let me find a clean occupation that I will not have to exert myself and be free to pursue the service of God and have plenty of time for that, I'm sure he would find something that is appropriate, but it won't be the kind of thing which you have to put all of your energy and all of your pursuit into just because of that pursuit of honor, which is so elusive anyway. Anyways, I want to get to a point here, because I want to cry out for help. Because yes, it's true, we are these people. We do fall in to the societal rat race, and yes, we are sucked in by desire for honor and desire of positions. We're not immune to this. But how does one help himself? If it is such a strong desire within man, how does one beat the desire? How does one lick this inclination?
By learning.
By studying Torah.
How does that help? And who says that's the answer? That sounds like a cop-out answer. And who says that helps? That's the right answer, by the way. But let's get to it.
By turning to people who don't seem to be in that rat race, who are content, you can ask them how they do it.
Ah, good. How do they get there? I just have to share with you a delicious little anecdote. I think it was David Ben-Gurion, first Prime Minister of Israel, went to visit the then chief rabbi of Jerusalem. And he was not the chief rabbi. I don't think he was a politically appointed chief rabbi. I think he was just regarded as the head rabbi, Rabbi Sonnenfeld, in the early years of the state. And he went to meet him. And he went to visit the rabbi, expecting the rabbi would be this nobleman living in some type of a mansion. He was directed to the rabbi's house, and it was in the Jewish quarter of the old city. And when he got there, he realized it was a very, very humble dwelling. And he looks at him almost in horror, and he says, "Rabbi, how can you live with such low level of honor for a man of your position?" The rabbi took him by the hand. This is so sweet. And he walks out to the Kotel, to the Western Wall. And he says, "Look where God lives." He's living in a ruined shack. Just one wall remains of his mansion. If he can live like that, I can certainly live like this. What a brilliant answer. But let's try to get to the guts of it, because it's not so easy. So first, one thing I just want to say in passing is that Rabbi Luzzatto really addressed the issue of honor back in Vigilance in Zahirus, and he gave some good advice. First of all, he pointed out something amazing. Not everybody is so driven by honor. Some people are driven much more than others. And those are, we would call today, the high achievers. He says, if you are a driven person like that, that's good. He says, you're going to accomplish things. But use your desire for honor in a good way. Use it to project your standing in the world to come. Because in the world to come, there's also going to be ranks. And there's also going to be levels. And if you're the kind of a person that can't stand to be on the lower echelons, how are you going to feel when you get to the world to come and you see other people who you look down upon, and yet they're higher than you because of their spiritual accomplishments? Go be a high achiever in the world of the spirit, in the eternal world. He actually encourages, because he says, not everybody is so driven. If you are driven, use it. But use it for eternal truth. So that's one idea I just want to throw out, because maybe the answer is not to subdue if we have this honor. Maybe it was given to us for a purpose. I know that I personally, growing up, I used to look at the rabbis that I looked up to, and I said, my goodness, they really, they sit at the at the head of the room, and they really are great, honorable people. And I used to say, boy, I'd like to be one of them. And that was probably a certain, low level. It wasn't necessarily a spiritual drive, but it was, young people are looking, who's important in the world? And I would look at important rabbis and see the respect that they're given, and that would motivate me. So he's saying, use it. But it's interesting that is an argument when you're working on Zahirus, but that argument doesn't fly when you're working on Nikius. When you're working on wholeness, he's not going to say, use the evil urge to accomplish good things. That's maybe on a lower level, and we should use it, by the way, because the sages say, "Olam yasok adam v'torov v'mitzvos shelo lishma." Better for a person, in fact, a person should always embark on the service of God for less than full, pure motives, because only through getting involved on the less than pure will a person reach higher levels. You can't start at the top. You got to work your way up. So let's not discount that. And if we do have a desire for honor, let's look at ourselves in the mirror and say, one day I'm going to be moved to a different company. And what's my rank going to be in that new company? And that's the company of the eternal world.
Yeah. Isn't there a distinction here between honor and the pursuit of honor?
Okay, how do you mean?
Pursuit of honor is what's not constructive and what's probably evil. But honor, in and of itself, something that's conferred on you by other people,
mm-hmm.
is probably perfectly fine, I would think.
So there's nothing wrong with having honor, just as long as you don't run after it.
Right.
That's like the person who went to his rabbi complaining, Rabbi, don't the sages say that a person who's always running away from honor will pursue him? Well, I've been running away from honor my whole life, and honor hasn't pursued me yet. And the rabbi says, how often do you look back over your shoulder? All right.
Rabbi.
Yes.
Torah, for example, about Moshe, we hear that he was the humblest man on earth. And yet, the stories that involve him involve his mistakes, his anger. We see illustrations of the faults of people in Torah, and we don't really get explanations of how they were great.
Okay, I'm not sure how that ties into our discussion right now.
Well, I mean, if we're going to learn by the example of great people, we have to learn how do we become humble? But we have no illustrations of
that. Okay, right. That's a good question, but I don't think it's for the current discussion, at least right at the moment. I'm sorry. That's a good question. So what is the answer from the standpoint of Nicias? I think it's well known in the world of addiction treatment that if somebody has an addiction, you don't just try to take it away from them. You have to replace it. Is that not what the, at least that's what I know Rabbi Dr. Abraham Tversky says, and he has developed what's called the 12-step process. Maybe it's actually developed by another group, but he adapted it to Jewish values. Anyways, he's a leader in the world of addiction treatment. But I think that's a pretty well accepted philosophy. You can't just take away an addiction, you have to replace it. Rabbi Luzzatto goes on to say that there is a kosher kavod. There is kavod, there is honor in the world. And he says, V'akavod ho'amiti, on page 89, Hakavod ho'amiti eino ela yediyas ha-Torah be'emes. The only true honor is true knowledge of the Torah. And then he quotes Pirkei Avos again. Ein kavod ela Torah. The only honor is that of the Torah. Kavod chachamim inchalu. The wise inherit honor. Anything else is merely imaginary and false honor, empty and serving no purpose. For the one who is clean, it is worth his while to cleanse and purify himself totally from the desire for honor. Then he will succeed. Okay. Very, very heavy. First of all, what's going on here? Are you telling me that if I'm not a Torah scholar, then I have no honor? Are you telling me that the only thing that's important is sitting down and studying day and night and becoming well-versed in the Talmud?
Yes.
And if I did not have that education, then I don't stand a chance? And what do you mean? Why are you telling me that there is something called honor? And then you tell me, cleanse myself from the desire for honor. Didn't you just replace it? Didn't you just say, don't run after how people look at you, run after Torah? So then I'm running after honor again.
No, you're running after Torah and you're given honor. And you're,
but he says honor, Torah is honor. Torah is honor.
I've seen this. I've been to labor before and been to some of the homes of the great men there. And they live so humbly. And they're so amazing. I mean, and they've written so many books, and they're so world-renowned. And they greet you at the door like you are part of their family. They've known you always with such kindness. So while they have such honor projected on them for the great achievements in Torah, they don't honor themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They honor Hashem and Hashem's word, and they use that to reach out to other people and to share the love of Hashem and the love of Torah. So, I mean, I understand that because I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
To see it, it's just... And it makes such an impression on you that it's like the whole world we live in is really fake. And that's really the only thing that's true.
Okay, let's go slowly. Thank you. Thank you for all of you for contributing, because I think we all get it. Let's take an example from the story of Purim to explain this concept. What I think it means, the honor is Torah. So, the Jews were in trouble. They were living in a host country. They were not in their land anymore. They were living in Persia. The king said that you have to come to my party. And everybody says, we have to go. Otherwise, we risk suffering persecution. We will insult the king. And who is who knows what he'll do then? So everybody, every common Jew, every rabbi said the right thing to do is to go and celebrate in Ahasuerus's party. Except for one man, Mordechai. He says, no, we shouldn't. They all thought he was a lunatic, a fanatic. In the end, Mordechai was vindicated. And in the end, our sages tell us, everyone realized that Mordechai was right. What happened here? Why did everyone see it one way and Mordechai saw it a different way? And why was he right? And also, how come one of the themes of the Purim story is that everything happened in the reverse? Haman wanted to kill Mordechai and the Jewish people. He prepared a gallows for Mordechai to hang on. And what happened? Haman got hung on the same gallows. Everything was backwards. And that is the theme of the Purim story. And also in that statement that we quoted before, whoever runs after honor, honor will run away from him. Whoever runs away from honor, honor runs to him. Isn't that kind of, it's very poetic, but isn't that kind of peculiar that the exact opposite happens? What is it about opposites? This is the point. The point is, and this is the kind of thing that it's not popular, it's not easy to accept. Because we like to believe that we know what's going on. We like to believe that what we see is what we get, that we know how to interpret things correctly. We are wise, we are educated, we are experienced. But Torah teaches that there are really two ways of looking at things. There is the imaginary, false, and empty way, which seems so attractive. And then there is the Torah way. If we're speaking intimately as friends, we really have to make the point that the Torah perspective on the world is quite the opposite of the general populace's look on the world. What's up is down, and what's down is up. And that is because man is given free will to run this world as he sees fit, particularly today. As we've spoken, we don't have that, you know, awareness of God's presence. So we are perfectly free to set the tone, to create values, and to run society as we see fit. And man's view, as great as man has a human view. And as Rabbi Lutzatzer tells us, man sees the here and the now. Man is imbued with different traits. These traits are very tricky. They're very illusory. And we tend to think that we know everything the way it looks in this world is the way it is. The way of the world is that he who has the most honor, the most money, the highest position, he is the successful one. And the Torah says the opposite. It has nothing to do with a person's financial standing or a person's popularity. It has to do with the knowledge of truth of God. That's what it means by Torah. It doesn't mean that you are a scholar and you know all of the more tractates you know, the more honor you have, because that's, again, falling into the human trap. You have to know more than somebody else and you have to be a greater scholar. That's the human definition of honor. The true definition of honor is Yediyas HaTorah Be'emes, the true knowledge of the Torah. That means which way is up and which way is down. And what happened in the story of the Megillah is that God bless them, all the Jews, and this is how it usually is. The masses and even the more righteous, they are still, we are human and we are affected by societal norms. And we view things politically. The normal reaction is if the king says we have to go to the party, then our success is going to depend on how we go along with him. And if we get on his bad side, we're going to suffer for it. That is the natural human response. But there is one person, perhaps in a generation, that you can count on who has attained true honor. Honor means Torah, the right perspective. That's what honor is. Honor is not what I get. Honor is what is the truth, God's truth, transmitted to man and obtained by man. And there could be one person in a generation that has that perspective of truth. And in this case, it was Mordechai. And Mordechai said, I know this is what it looks like, but that's not the truth. How did he figure it out? Because he was who he was. He pursued the truth of Torah for his entire life. He sacrificed for it. He taught it to others. And he lived his life for the pursuit of true honor, which is Torah. Just like the rabbi said to the prime minister, I live my life for God. I don't live my life for my honor. I live in a humble house because God lives in a humble house. It took a great person, a great Torah perspective to see that. And what we really have to do, a person who wants to embark on the path of the just, is he has to, at a certain level, again, where we don't jump into this, we don't go around and start saying that everything is false and everybody's wrong. We don't do that because we're not living on that level. But there is a subtle pursuit within the righteous person's mindset. I'm looking for that which is not the obvious. I'm almost looking for opposites. I'm looking for what common man thinks, and then I'm looking to see what God thinks. And I'm pretty sure 9 out of 10 times there's going to be an element of oppositeness there. And that is what the Purim story teaches us. It says that when the people, after the story of Purim, it's amazing, the Talmud says that they reaffirmed their acceptance of the Torah on Sinai. When? After the Purim miracle. Why all of a sudden? They already had accepted the Torah at Mount Sinai. Why did they have to reaffirm that? Because there had been some doubts. People were looking maybe at Mordechai as kind of that old, ancient, unworldly rabbi. What does he know? Get with the times, old man. Come on, we're living in the new world. Maybe the Torah is for Israel, but it's not for Persia. And when they saw that it was that old rabbi who did have his head on straight, and he did have the proper perspective of Torah, they said, my goodness, we didn't realize just how great the Torah was. It's something that we should embrace wherever we are and whenever we live and within whosoever reign we reside. We're looking for Torah. And when they saw that Mordechai was right, they reaffirmed the acceptance of the Torah, which was there all along. I hope I did a decent job making my point. We have a treasure. We have a treasure. We're sitting on a treasure. We are the, as we spoke last week, we were 2 weeks ago, mankind was given chachma. Mankind was given immense wisdom to be able to fathom great mysteries of the world. But we, the Jewish people, were given Torah. And that carries with it a whole different vision and a whole different perspective. And that is what is our heritage, and that is the true honor. What people think, given the human perspective, it could be that everyone's running to that tune, but Ein Kavod El Torah, we aspire to, is the true honor, which is Yediyas HaTorah B'Emes. May we find it, and may particularly as we experience Purim, may we be infused with that great appreciation and reaffirmation for Torah and for the true honor. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.